You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on spondyloarthritis hosted by Med Learning Group. This podcast is first in a series of two geared towards rheumatologists and other caregivers involved in the management of spondyloarthritis. In this podcast, Dr. Alexis Ogdi will discuss some of the clinical features of spondyloarthritis, as well as how to distinguish between subtypes. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Ogdi, who's joining us today. Dr. Ogdi is an associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. She is also director of the Penn Psoriatic Arthritis Clinic at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Ogdi, I appreciate you joining us today to talk about spondyloarthritis.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here today.
So let's just dive in with back pain. One of the primary complaints of patients who are eventually diagnosed with spondyloarthritis is back pain, but that can be a pretty vague complaint the first time you hear of it. So how do you define back pain specifically as it relates to spondyloarthritis?
Well, when we're talking about spondyloarthritis, often we're thinking about inflammatory back pain. And this can be kind of hard because the concept of inflammatory back pain, we always think about axSpA, but the symptoms can kind of go back and forth between mechanical back pain and inflammatory back pain. But maybe I'll start with talking about inflammatory back pain and kind of what we've all learned, and I'll back into how we use it in clinic and how it might manifest. So inflammatory back pain is generally occurring in a patient who's under the age of 45. So there's this age component. It's associated with morning stiffness. And the stiffness is usually going to be 30 minutes or 45 minutes or longer. If you have mechanical back pain, for example, if you've played tennis lately and twisted a little bit funny and you got a little back pain there, it's stiff in the morning when you first get up, but that goes away pretty quickly. Whereas an inflammatory back pain type is going to have much more morning stiffness. In general, this is going on for 3 months or longer. That's kind of maybe outside of how we define it, but generally if it's present for a short period of time, not as concerning as someone who's had it for 3 months or more. And then it tends to get better with exercise. Once again, you know, that is a characteristic finding of inflammatory back pain and axSpA in particular. Although if you have a mechanical issue, like let's say a muscle strain also tends to feel a little bit better as someone starts to kind of move it gently, but it might also get worse when you're moving. So inflammatory back pain in general feels better as patients are moving, and they'll tell you that they're standing and walking around as opposed to sitting down or laying down. Improvement with rest is a no for inflammatory back pain. So again, they want to be moving. They don't want to be at rest. The more they're resting, the more stiffness they get. Then there's this concept of pain at night. Again, this is one that's difficult to distinguish, but what we really mean by this is pain in the second half of the night. So the patient goes to sleep okay, and they feel maybe better because they've been moving around during the day. They lay down, they fall asleep, and then somewhere around 2 a.m. or that second half of the night, they wake up and they feel really stiff. So it's hard to roll over or hard to get up to go to the bathroom, for example. And again, it's stiffness, not necessarily pain. And then there's some of the other things like response to NSAIDs, for example, is often associated with inflammatory back pain. There was a recent study presented last year by Xenophon Bourliakos that suggested that was actually no different between mechanical back pain and inflammatory back pain. So just to summarize, you know, one of the ways to think about inflammatory back pain is the eye pain mnemonic. So it's an insidious onset, pain at night with improvement upon getting up, age of onset less than 40 or 45, depending on which one you look at. I is improvement with exercise, and then N is no improvement with rest. So that's one mnemonic you can use. But like I said, it's really hard to kind of separate these things out from mechanical back pain sometimes as well.
So let's kind of continue on the inflammatory back pain vein. So say you've eliminated mechanical back pain or pain resulting from some sort of trauma during the workup, say a car accident or something, and now you suspect inflammatory back pain. So what's your next step for distinguishing between types of spondyloarthritis?
Great. So you have this patient who has inflammatory back pain, maybe it's a young man or woman, and they don't have any history of trauma. So we're going to go through a really thorough history to understand, first of all, what other symptoms they may be having. Do they have any skin involvement like psoriasis? Do they have diarrhea with blood in the stool or mucus in the stool, for example, that could be Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, so inflammatory bowel disease, any history of uveitis or red eye that's really painful? So we'll kind of get some of those historical elements. We'll also ask about family history and whether they have a family history of psoriasis, IBD, uveitis, psoriatic arthritis, or axSpA arthritis. Because family history is really strongly tied as well. So then once we kind of have a sense of those things, as well as their general review systems, just to make sure there's nothing else that's sneaking in there, like, you know, Sjogren's can have general joint pain, for example, but it's going to have a different set of symptoms. So we're going to kind of go through our general review systems for a patient with a potential inflammatory disorder and make sure that this is the kind of one of the things that we're really pursuing. I forgot to mention the key one, which is peripheral joint involvement. So you want to know whether or not the patient has joint swelling, if they have any tendon or ligament involvement. So for example, Achilles tendonitis, or what was diagnosed as Achilles tendonitis, may have been enthesitis, one of the key spondyloarthritis features. So we'll kind of go through all those and then say, do they fit criteria, for example, for AxSpA?
So you alluded to the two main types of spondyloarthritis, that being axial spondyloarthritis versus peripheral spondyloarthritis. But let's go a little bit deeper. So specifically for the axial category, what are the subtypes within this category and what are some of the features of the axial subtype of spondyloarthritis?
Yeah, so back when I was in medical school, we called this ankylosing spondylitis. So the name has been updated to axial spondyloarthritis. And then under that category, there's radiographic axial spondyloarthritis and non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. So radiographic AxSpA is AS. So that's what we learned about in medical school back in the early 2000s, if you were in medical school at that time. I think actually only in the last few years have we really been teaching medical students slightly differently because this is much more of an accepted concept. And then there's this idea of non-radiographic AxSpA. What that means is really there's nothing on the X-ray that suggests significant damage. So they don't meet that modified New York criteria that you would meet for AS. If it's non-radiographic, though, often they do have inflammation on MRI. At least 75% of these patients should have something on MRI when you image their SI joints. And maybe they have something elsewhere, but we focus really on the SI joints in terms of kind of figuring out is it radiographic or non-radiographic. So in the workup, you'll get a pelvis X-ray or X-ray of the sacroiliac joints. If there's nothing on the X-ray, if there's something on the X-ray, there you go, you got your diagnosis. If there's nothing on the X-ray, then you order an MRI of the sacrum or of the sacroiliac joints, depending on where you are. No contrast. And then you're going to look for bone marrow edema, for erosions, for sclerosis on the MRI. And then that'll help you determine, is this non-radiographic AxSpA?
Okay, excellent. So that's the axial category. Now let's move to the peripheral type of spondyloarthritis. Same question. What are the subtypes in the peripheral category and what are some of their clinical features?
Yeah, so peripheral SPA can be thought of in a few different ways. One is that it's just one easy way of differentiating this whole category of spondyloarthritides. But if you look at a Venn diagram, there's tons of overlap here. So people with peripheral SPA, maybe psoriatic arthritis, or it could be reactive arthritis, especially if it's just a short-lived kind of syndrome, or kind of the wastebasket, like we're not really sure, and then they're peripheral, but they don't have axial disease. I tend to think of it more as they have psoriatic arthritis, they have IBD-associated arthritis, maybe reactive arthritis, or axial spondyloarthritis, and then there's undifferentiated SPA. So it just depends on like what side of the slide you stand on. But in general, these have a lot of overlap among them.
So let's go a little bit further with the peripheral subtype and talk a little bit about psoriatic arthritis. Where does this fit into the whole spectrum of treatment? And I know there's a lot going on with this particular area. Talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, so psoriatic arthritis tends to be a peripheral inflammatory arthritis that is associated with psoriasis. But there are a subset where axial disease is either a part of the disease or more a predominant component of the disease. We think about 20% of patients with psoriatic arthritis have axial disease. And in fact, sometimes people have axial symptoms and you don't quite capture it on the imaging. That may be because they're already taking medicines for their peripheral arthritis, for example. This has been a big area of investigation because some therapies have demonstrated that patient-reported outcomes for spinal symptoms improve when you start the medicine, but those medicines don't seem to be active in ankylosing spondylitis studies. So there's a few things there. One is that there tend to be the interleukin-23s, for example, were not effective in ankylosing spondylitis or radiographic AxSpA. They weren't really tested well in or tested in non-radiographic disease. But we know that they work well in psoriatic arthritis, and they improved the BAS dye, which is a measure considered to be a measure of axial disease in PSA. So there's this question, do interleukin-23s work for a patient with psoriatic arthritis who also has axial disease? I think there's a couple large studies that are pending right now that are going to help answer these types of questions. So one of those studies is a randomized controlled trial of guselkumab versus placebo in patients with psoriatic arthritis who also have axial disease. And that'll really help us understand, does this really work for this subpopulation of patients? But in addition, there's a broader study that's being conducted right now that's going to answer the question of what is axial disease in psoriatic arthritis. They're studying a large population of patients with psoriatic arthritis and looking in more detail at what are the phenotypes of axial disease seen. And it is a little different sometimes. Like, you might see more cervical disease, and you may see more cervical disease even in the absence of SI joints inflammation, although it's not that common. So the psoriatic arthritis subtype of axial disease may be different, but it may not be different. And I think we'll have answers to that in the next year or so.
So we're going to discuss treatment a little bit more in the second podcast, but just briefly here, once you've reached a specific diagnosis, whether it's ankylosing spondylitis, psoriatic arthritis, reactive arthritis, et cetera, where do you start with treatment? Like, what guidelines are out there to guide clinical treatment decision-making?
Yeah, so there's a variety of different guidelines, either the GRAPPA treatment guidelines for psoriatic arthritis if the patient also has psoriasis, or the EULAR guidelines for axial spondyloarthritis, or Spartan ACR guidelines. And really, they're all very similar. I think whichever of those guidelines you take, I actually think the GRAPPA guidelines have a very nice way to kind of think about this. So any patient with SPA, so let's take whether even just the axial spondyloarthritis patient, we want to assess what features do they have. So do they have axial involvement? Yes, in this case they do, because we said there's an axial patient. Do they have peripheral involvement? So is there peripheral arthritis? Is there enthesitis or inflammation where tendon, ligament, or joint capsule inserts onto the bone? And then is there associated features like psoriasis, for example? And if they have psoriasis, do they have nail disease? Do they have inflammatory bowel disease or uveitis? So once we kind of have the lay of the land of what are their disease features, then we can kind of think about a treatment plan. If they have axial disease, this is really going to drive the choice of therapy, because there's only three therapy groups that are approved for axial disease. And those are the TNF inhibitors, IL-17 inhibitors, and JAK inhibitors. But if they have peripheral arthritis as well, you can kind of pull in sulfasalazine, for example. If they have more enthesitis, you're going to be maybe thinking more about using some NSAIDs to get that down, and then using a biologic potentially. So, you know, the kind of main message here is make sure you're assessing for all of those features and knowing whether or not they have uveitis, psoriasis, or IBD as well to help make an informed treatment plan.
So let's finish up this podcast with just a few concluding remarks. As a rheumatologist, how often do you see these conditions? And I mean, do you think we're in a good spot with classification criteria and guidelines to direct treatment for these patients?
You know, it's a really interesting time right now in axial spondyloarthritis, because there's been a lot of activity in terms of diagnostics and diagnosis. So I think lots of interest in the imaging components and what actually is positive. There's a strong recognition that our average musculoskeletal radiologists, or particularly any radiologist, they have a lot of different disagreement when you look at one single image. People call it different things. So I think I always make the call for a rheumatologist getting to know how to read MRIs of the pelvis, because it's so helpful in terms of understanding a radiologist's perspective. So that's number one. So they've been working a lot of AI algorithms. It might be able to be applied to help with differentiating patient with not with disease versus the patient with disease according to their MRI or x-ray. So that's number one. The other piece is that both groups, EULAR or ASAS and Spartan, have been working on rethinking classification criteria, or at least going back to it and saying, is this accurate or helpful? And so Spartan ran a very large study called the CLASSIC study, which I think will probably be published relatively soon. It's been presented at EULAR and ACR in 2023. So that study showed, you know, lots of differences in these features, and that maybe some of them don't have the good positive predictive value that we thought they did. And imaging is a really strong indicator of whether or not someone does have axial spondyloarthritis or not. So I think there's a lot to learn here yet. And I have a feeling that over the next 2 years, this will be in a kind of an exciting area where lots of things are unfolding. And maybe there's at least some minor modifications, and maybe major, but I think minor modifications to the current classification criteria.
Well, that definitely sounds pretty promising. But thank you very much, Dr. Agdi. This has been an excellent discussion on some of the underlying mechanisms of spondyloarthritis and differentiating between subtypes of the disease. But that's it for now. Once again, thank you, Dr. Agdi, for joining us. Thanks to all of our listeners for joining as well. As a reminder, MedLearning Group offers many types of CME programs across a variety of disease states, including several rheumatology topics. I invite you to explore these on our website, www.medlearninggroup.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Eli Lilly, who provided unrestricted grants for this educational activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.